this week on The Inside Flap.
I did a lot of mixed martial arts training and fighting and choke holds to practice for this. It doesn't imply that I'm good at these things.
Right.
You know, my training was largely a process of me having my face introduced consecutively to the training mat over the process of 10 weeks.
Paul Blart, Mall Cop.
Oh my goodness gracious.
Not just Paul Blart. Oh, remember, then this is going to represent the East Theater Company. We just put on a Greek tragedy, Antigone. We've done Shakespeare in the past, and this is the movie he wants to represent, level two.
Well, Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2, that is a tragedy. Yeah.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus. And welcome to the show. Seated across the room to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. And resting comfortably on the couch to my left. Why, that's Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
Excelsior. Thank you so much for joining us.
The Inside Flap.
On The Inside Flap, a book podcast. This is episode 243, and we have a great guest for you. We are joined by Greg Hurwitz, the New York Times number one internationally bestselling author of 24 thrillers, including the Orphan X series. He's got a new book out now. It's called Lone Wolf, number 9 in the series. It is really, really good. And we'll have that conversation for you in just a bit. But first, so to steal a line from Andrew, it's been a busy week. It's been a busy week.
Tuesday.
It's only Tuesday. What? Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Happy Galentine's Day as we record this.
Oh, it is Galentine's Day.
Where's the world's smallest violin?
Been a busy week at school. So we've been working late building the set for our spring production of Urinetown, and so Deb wanted these spiral staircases, and I think I've mentioned it on the show, building these not spiral, but they turn. They're twisty spiral staircases that turn 90 degrees, and they go up 8 feet tall.
It sounds like a spiral staircase.
Okay, that's true. Well, it's not like
it's a curve.
It's a curve.
Beautiful curve.
A winding.
Curve.
A winding staircase.
It's circular, though. I wouldn't call it spiral. It's circular. It's like if you... Did you do a radius with a circle?
No.
Oh.
What are you dealing with there?
I don't know.
I watched a couple of YouTube videos. I said, well, I can't do that. And then just... I've been winging it ever since.
They look fantastic.
Well, we're getting there, but... So there needs to be two of them, one for each side of the set. There's a platform that's 8 foot high, and the staircases have to go up to the platform. It's Mr. Gladstone's or Gladwell's office.
Okay.
And so the stairs go up to that, one on the right, one
for
on stage
Urinetown.
Right, and one on stage left. Yes.
Yeah.
So we built these two. So we spent a lot of time. We built each step individually. We mounted it on plywood, and the plywood is on wheels because they have to be able to wheel them all around because she wants dancers on them, and they need to have railings. And so we built two of them.
Oh, my goodness.
There's 10 steps, and each step is individually built, and then they're mounted, like I said, and then they're all hooked together so they don't move around. We built them both, and I'm looking at them. I'm like, man, that looks great. That really came together. They look fantastic. They got wheels on them. They got like 8 wheels. We can move them all over the place. Each wheel is rated for 250 pounds. It's plenty of weight. Great. Wonderful. Then we kind of go to wheel them into position to put one on the left-hand side of the platform and one on the right.
So they're symmetrical as you look
exactly.
At the stage.
Well, Andrew, see if you can figure out what we did wrong.
I can. I mean, not without more.
Because they're looking for symmetry.
We want symmetry. We want
but
one
he made
on the left.
Both of them exactly gotcha. Like the
yeah.
other.
Yeah, gotcha.
You yes. figure it out?
Yes.
Yeah. So we built both of them on the exact same curve. So they both curve to the right. which renders one of them completely useless. So we had to take the whole thing apart, take each individual step that had been attached to each other apart. We had to flip over the base because the base was cut to a curve. We had to flip over the base, put the wheels on the opposite side, rebuilt that. And that's the whole process has just been like one step forward and two steps back.
I have a question. Yes. Do you think, you know, all the nice AI generating images and stuff where you can be very detailed and tell it what you're looking for? I wonder if you could speak or type and create like the set as best as you can. So it's an image so you guys could look at it and reference it while you're building. Because if you had plans or a sketch, not even plans, let's just say a sketch of what it would look like, it wouldn't have happened.
We have had none of that.
But I'm thinking that's a free tool. I think it's free. Maybe if whatever. But I mean, it could be a really nice.
Maybe. We really don't know what we're doing.
That could be a great one.
As we go.
Yeah. And then you could see what things look like because you can alter it and change it.
Yeah. Well, now I'm trying to put up planking so it's nice and smooth.
It did look good. That looked good.
And it's really tough. So every step has to be taken out and readjusted for this one. So each step has been taken out at least two times. And maybe by the time we're all done with this, it's.
Well, Dave, you know what they say.
Yes.
Two steps forward, one step back.
That's right.
I had
Even get me started on the curved handrail. That's been an absolute nightmare.
So I had a three-level home once, and something happened, and it was a miscommunication between the hardwood floor guy and the contractor.
Yeah.
And the bottom step was not the same, was like 7 inches high.
I do remember.
And the top step all the way at the third floor was like 7 1/4, 7 and a half inches high. And they had to redo the landings to get things to match.
The nice thing about building for the stage.
Because the inspector measures.
Yeah, there's no code. You don't have to build for code. Build to code.
Handrails, I have seen them come, put it in, take it out, go back to the shop.
Right. Yeah.
Come back to the client's house. Bring it in. The client's standing there wringing their hands.
We're taking
it doesn't quite work. They take it back out.
Very thin
plywood,
and we've cut it into like 2-inch strips. Or maybe, I think like 4-inch strips, and then glued them together to like have created like a 3-ply or almost a 4-ply, I think, in some cases, and then screwed it onto the post so it bends and twists. Oh. It's an absolute.
It's hard. Right. That's hard.
Yeah,
you know, the overprotective dad in me, like I hear like 8-foot staircases.
I know, I think that too.
And people think, 8 foot's
a lot. Yeah, it's over your head.
Well, my son Peter decided he wanted to get some like drywall stilts, right?
Oh.
And so we get some drywall stilts.
Is he going to be doing some drywall?
Finishing the ceiling work.
He wanted to experiment with like walking around on stilts. So he's like, let's buy some drywall stilts. So we did. And these things were only 18 inches, right?
Ooh,
like,
yeah.
Right. But still, he got up on these 18 inch stilts, and you just wouldn't believe, like, how much dangerous it is.
Right.
The fact that he's 18 inches higher above the ground than he normally is. You know, and that's just 18 inches.
Right. You know, these steps are no joke.
You're going to have a guardrail around the platform that the office is, right? Like, right. No one can.
No. In fact, now Deb's looking into buying a trampoline for the fall because Mr. Gladstone, he's got a fall, Bobby, he's got a fall off the balcony.
Trampoline is really dangerous.
And we're going to, she wants to have him fall onto a trampoline.
She's better off getting like one of those air mattresses.
Right. Well, I know, but we got to bring it.
A trampy's going to come bouncing back up again.
And that's the point. It's going to be because he sustains a long note as he falls.
From 8 feet?
Oh, and he's singing this long note. Yeah, from 8 feet.
Man, who's the safety director on the set?
We don't have our safety director.
This is very concerning, I feel like. Yeah. He needs to be in a harness, basically, if you're going to do something like that.
Well, we'll certainly put him in a harness.
Put him in a harness,
Put him in a harness, yeah.
Woo, boy.
But we also...
Taylor Swift almost fell down the Folklore House recently. True.
I did want to give a before we continue on. I did want to give a shout out to my level two classes. We had our level two performance, and Laura's still mad at me that I didn't.
Oh.
I told Laura and Sylvia to stay home to not bother coming and see it, and this is why. Andrew, let me tell you why. So we gave our students the option. We said, all right, so we've been studying stage combat and we've been studying dialects in class. And we said, all right, listen, choose two movies and you guys will do scenes from these two movies for our level two performance. Each level in theater at East High School gets a performance. And the level two performance is going to be dialects and stage combat through scenes from two different movies. So her two movies, they chose The Princess Bride and they chose Monty Python and The Holy Grail.
Okay.
Holy Grail. Both great movies to showcase those two items. I said to my kids, I said, look, here's what we're going to do. I got the whiteboard in front of the screen, in front of the class. Go up and write down as many movies as you can think of, and then we'll vote and narrow it down, and then you can come up, once we got it to a list of about 10, each person who nominated a movie, they can come up and they can pitch that movie for why it would make for a good movie to be used for these two items. So we had like 35 movies up there. The kids, I said, vote as many times as you want and we'll winnow it down. So we winnowed it down. And there was one movie in particular. I said, I spent so much time making fun of this movie that they wrote on there that every single kid voted for this movie. I'm like, okay, so this must be some kind of joke. Fine, it won't make the final. So we got the list of final 10. And one of the movies was Shrek. Graham came up. He spoke for Shrek. Did a great job pitching the movie Shrek. And we went on. There was other. American Psycho was one. There was some really interesting movies. Wolf of Wall Street was one.
Do you have a lot of boys in your class? More than girls? More boys than girls?
Oh, no. More girls than boys.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Just wondering.
So, no Mean Girls was another movie.
Okay,
Heathers was a movie.
I was going to say, it's a lot of like boy-dominated films I'm hearing.
This is Dave's perspective.
True.
Yeah. Right.
True.
Yeah, those are the two that stuck in my mind.
Yeah.
So then they get to this one movie that I consider to be an outlier. I thought it was even nominated as a joke. And I said, whoever put this one up on the board, come up and pitch it. And the kid's name, we'll give him a shout out. He has the same name as your son, Andrew. Oh. His name is Dashiell. So Dashiell comes up.
Another Dashiell.
And here's the movie that he pitches. The movie is Paul Blart, Mall Cop.
Oh my goodness gracious.
Two! Not just Paul Blart. Remember, then this is going to represent the East Theater Company. We just put on a Greek tragedy, Antigone. We've done Shakespeare in the past, and this is the movie he wants to represent level two.
Well, Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2, that is a tragedy.
Yeah. We looked it up on Rotten Tomatoes. You know what it's getting on Rotten Tomatoes?
37%.
Oh, you are up by 31%. It is at 6.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
0.6%. And with the audience, it's like 17%. And even Dashiell admitted, he's like, listen. And he talked about it's getting at 6%, but then he just went into this whole impassioned speech.
Does he like the film?
He loves the film.
I like how I'm calling it a film, movie. I'm just going to call it a movie.
I don't know. That is a good question. I'll have to ask him if he actually likes it.
Is it ironic? Well,
I don't know.
Well, the thing is it so bad?
That's the thing.
It's funny.
Right.
Just because it's so bad. I mean, there's Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like one of the worst science fiction movies ever made.
Yeah.
But it's so bad that it's become a classic because...
That's true.
Yeah.
It's ironically bad.
And some of the Ed Wood stuff.
I don't know if that was the purpose of it, but he spoke...
What's that guy? What's that actor's
name? From the heart. Johnny Depp?
King Queens.
Oh, yeah.
Paul Blart.
Kevin James.
That's Paul Blart. Yeah. Super likable.
Dashiell spoke at great length about what scenes would be so good for us to perform that when it came down to it, every kid voted for it. So we ended up doing scenes from Shrek and Paul Blart.
Sounds like a good salesman.
And it was fantastic. Mm. And it was one of those things where they were able to ham it up and play it over the top. And it worked. And the audience loved it.
Mm. And genuine laughs.
Really well. Genuine laughter.
Interesting. Yeah.
And shout out to Bryn, who was doing a scene from Shrek, who had to get her head dunked in a... So they're like, Dave, we need a bucket of water. We need a bucket of water. I'm like, what do we need? We're not setting anything on fire. Are we like, no, Bryn's got to get her head dunked in this bucket of water. I said, okay, so we got a bucket of water. Well, she forgot to breathe when they're dunking her in this thing.
Oh.
So they dunked her three times. And I guess the second time she forgot to... That someone missed a cue or something, but she put her head right back in. And, you know, in stage combat, you lead the thing. Like, they don't dunk it. Like, their hand is just on the back of her head. Like, she puts her own head in the water, but something happened where she forgot to breathe. And
common mistake.
She's up on stage gasping for air, and I'm watching the scene. I'm like, wow, Bryn is really an amazing actress. Look at that. She looks like she was really out of breath. Well, it turns out that yes, she was really out of breath. And this was something that was an ongoing process when we did the unit on stage combat.
Method.
I got 30 kids with swords, metal swords, and they're throwing themselves around. We're in the auxiliary gym, and it's padded.
Andrew, you love this.
They're doing these scenes every day. I teach them a different skill, then they put together a small scene, they rehearse the scene, then they showcase it for the class. What, they're flopping around, they're screaming in pain, and every single time it always gets me. I'm like, are you okay? Are you okay? Like, yeah, Dave, it's called acting. It's called acting. But it was just it was a whole month
of
watching them writhe around on the ground in pain. And I never knew, like, if they were real. I would, because one kid, I mean, he threw, so they were doing a scene, and this was early on. He threw himself into the wall, and he did it to himself. And he literally separated his shoulder by throwing himself into the wall. And so, like after that, I'm like, okay, guys, we have to learn. And you spend plenty of time teaching safety. That's first, last, and always rule is safety. But I was so glad when we were out of that unit.
So, what are the three most dangerous words in theater class?
What?
Hey, watch this.
Yeah. That's true. Some might say, and your teacher, Dave Medicus. That might, some might say that. Anyway, so that's what's been going on for me. Laura, how have you been?
Oh, I've been great. You know, last week was a little bit doom and gloom with Nelson.
Yes.
He, the medication that the doc gave him has been helping him. And,
he's been
Absolutely. Back to attacking the cat, barking at passerbys who dare to walk their dog past his door. He's been frisky and eating and back up to basically, you know, our good old lovable Nelson. So that's been a huge relief. And then I had a friend from high school who had come out for a visit.
Yes, and Renata.
I had been so afraid that we would have to like put the dog down the same day that she was here. Like it would have been... And so that was wonderful that we didn't, like, I could joke about Nelson having cancer without, I mean, not joke, but, you know, got to make something out of it. But it was so great to see her. And I don't live in the same town that I went to high school with. We don't live remotely close to it. And just having a friend who you've known for a very long time, there is something just really wonderful about that. And you don't have to... see them all the time or even talk to them all the time, but then, you know, they show up and you see them once a year or you know, every once in a while, and it's just like old times.
Yeah, well, it's really amazing. It's so easy just to fall back into,
you know
each other's in jokes. It's easy to rib each other. She told a hilarious story about a robot where she stared at the robot and the robot stared back at her.
She did. It was a Martha Wells book, The Murder Bots.
I was able to... jump on that and ridicule her mercilessly.
We had a great time though. So she's been a New Yorker, like New York City person for at least 25 years that I can figure. Mm. So when you have a New Yorker that comes out and visits you, you don't want to appear. I don't want to appear pokey and too suburban.
Right. You did hide all the cowboy hats.
So I
seriously?
No, I'm fine with the cowboy hats.
Yeah.
Like we have all these cowboy hats lying around.
We don't have.
I have one hanging up in our bedroom.
You did. You did not take her to the mall, which I know we like to go to the mall every weekend.
So we did go. It did snow, and I did take her to an indoor Maker's Mart, which you might say was a mall.
Oh no, really?
But that we actually had a great time, and it was filled with like hip and young, cool. Aspen Grove. Okay. Did you guys go there?
No.
Oh, how'd you know about it?
It's just, you know, we're in Aspen Grove all the time.
Oh, yeah. It was called the Valentine's Day Bazaar or something. But it was filled with makers. And one funny thing that they had at this place, so they had all kinds of really wonderful people who are making vegan soap and jewelry and young artists and like stuff that's like earth conscious, social conscious, but also like nice stuff. But they had one weird thing they had was bring your dog and you can get some type of like an Instagrammable moment with you and your dog. So what they had was a young man dressed with like a very short gold toga, bare chested with like a toga going across his chest. Like imagine a beauty queen pageant, like Miss Maryland. He had a gold sash across his bare chest.
How old was this gentleman?
20s.
Okay.
Just celebrity, the sweet spot.
Celebrity that he most resembles.
Swarthy Latin fella?
He had dark hair, but he was a little more French looking, perhaps. Like a... I'm not up on the current celebrities, but he would have fit in with all that young...
So like a young Gerard Depardieu?
No, much better looking than Gerard Depardieu.
He's the only French actor that comes to mind for Andrew.
Honestly, like a young John Cusack is what I would say.
Okay.
Except more built because he is wearing a gold sash. But it was, and he had a nose ring too.
A shaved chest? Or?
I didn't really, I mean, if it makes you feel any better, I really didn't actually notice. Okay. I didn't look.
So like a skinny, like John Cena?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
No. Like a John Cusack.
Okay.
With a nose ring and a little more muscular.
Like one of those nose rings between the nostrils?
No, like what Sylvia has, a little gold hoop on one of the nostrils.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I liked. I thought that was nice. But I was a little uncomfortable because he's there and then he's got...
What's he doing? Just walking around?
No.
Are you supposed to get your picture taken with him?
Yeah, so there was a middle-aged woman, probably my age, and she had her little border collie with her.
Yeah.
And she hopped up onto the sofa, this love seat next to him, and put her dog like in her lap. And then he leaned in with her and then they got a picture taken together.
What?
And he had little arrows. He had like little Cupid quiver.
Oh my goodness.
With arrows.
Oh, boy.
And like there might have been some inflatable balloons behind him.
What kind of footwear did he have on?
I think sandals. Yeah.
The sandals. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense.
Like thong type of sandals.
Was he
and
did he have like bronzed, like a
spray
tan?
No, he was pale.
That's weird.
I thought that was weird too.
He had to put on like a spray tan.
He was not what you would envision if I say, hey, we're going to have a 20-something year old male Cupid.
He's too pale.
And you middle-aged ladies are going to get your happiness by taking your dog, who is your Valentine, and getting your picture taken with your dog in this young...
Now, would he like put his arm around the women?
No, he was respectful.
Oh, okay.
No. Okay. He probably would have if the woman had wanted that, though. We just saw one woman. We saw one woman with the dog. But that was one of the stranger things that I saw.
Did he hold the dog? Did he pet the dog?
No. Uh-uh.
Just this weird guy dressed as Cupid.
He was dressed as Cupid. And honestly, his outfit was a little too short.
How short were the shorts?
They were very short.
Were they like, I mean...
Like very short, like... It wasn't shorts. It was like a skirt, like a, do you know what I mean? Like a toga, but it was a shorty toga, like a shorty robe.
Did anybody try to look up his shorty robe?
I hope not. Okay. The thing is, I'm old enough to be this fella's mother.
Right.
So my concern was, I hope he feels okay.
Your concern that he was cold out there?
Didn't feel concerned because he had hot lights. He was in a back room and they had hot lights.
Oh, they
on
kept him in the back room.
Where's this conversation going? I'm starting to get a little concerned.
Because Renata and I, we had been sampling, like smelling soaps,
sampling hot sauce,
moving around, talking to people, having a very good time actually talking to these different makers. And we walk by a back room and we see this half naked guy Okay. And he's lit under a spotlight. And Renata goes, huh.
What is this? I must investigate
this. What is this?
So we must get a closer look.
So this is the theme for this episode is another Greek tragedy.
Yes. Tragedy. But it was, I felt kind of bad because there were some dads and moms of dogs who were there. And I felt a little sorry for the dads.
The dads, sure. They're walking around with their dad bods. And they're here.
Well, no, are they supposed to get their picture with this male Cupid? Did they have a female Cupid running around? I don't think they did.
No, we can't.
That wouldn't
can't
have been very
that.
PC.
You can't do that.
It felt a little not PC either way.
Right.
It was odd. It was
Did
one of the stranger
to
things.
Did you pay to get your picture taken with this guy?
No, No, they just had him there.
So you know. So you wonder. Don't you know? You wonder who comes up with this idea.
You do wonder.
You know.
Well, you wonder how many drugs they're on when they come up with this idea.
Yeah. I mean, he seemed like a nice boy.
It was a family event, right? I'm assuming there are little kids running around. Well, it's not like
There weren't a lot of little kids because the other odd thing is, I thought they'd have food there. So we went around lunchtime. It had looked like there would be food trucks. It was snowing heavily on Saturday.
Some feta cheese.
So there was no food trucks. So all they had was a bar. Mm. They had a lot of booze. Like they had a sip and shop kind of thing going on. Mm. They had mimosas. They had like a bar. They had alcohol. Didn't see any food. So you get loaded, buy things, and then get your picture taken with Cupid.
Shot in the butt. Were these real arrows? Do we know?
No, they were not real
suction cup arrows.
No, okay. They were artful and pretty arrows.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, that was my weekend. Andrew, how are you?
Busy. You know, it's
what?
It's the usual. Yeah. So I should say that we heard from an author of a book we reviewed last week. And you know, normally when it comes to the science fiction and the fantasy novels, we don't typically hear from the authors.
Sometimes, every once in a while we do, though.
Yeah. And so it was good to hear from Ellie Modesset Jr.
Mm-hmm. Modesset Jr.
I said it fast.
Okay.
Modesset. Now, I basically have been reading his books for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Ellie Modesset has written over 80 books.
Wow.
Right? And so for three decades, I've been reading his books. And I don't know if when I started reading his books, I didn't see the junior there, but it turns out in an email that we got, he wanted to let us know that it isn't a father-son duo that's written these 80 novels. It is one man.
Question. How come you thought it was a father-son duo?
No.
Just because it had gone on for so long and you're it has to be two people?
And I think maybe I started paying attention to the junior.
Oh.
You know, maybe 30 years ago in my 20s when I started reading the books.
That makes sense.
I didn't pay attention to the junior, and I wonder too if going back and looking at the books, if they didn't emphasize the junior on the book.
Yeah.
But now it's
there. But you just noticed it, yeah.
Yeah, now it's there. So a mistake, but you know, it's one man that's written 80 books.
Wow.
Now, in terms of always say it's a small world, and it turns out that Ellie Modesset was born here in Denver, right? And his biography says Denver. But he emailed us and said that his dad was from the Littleton Cherry Hills area, you know. So I wonder, if he went to school here, what schools he went to.
Because we're in the Littleton I wouldn't call us Cherry Hills, but we are very close to Cherry Hills.
Yeah,
in Littleton.
We're in the Cherry Corridor.
We are the servants to the Cherry Hills mansions. Is what our houses are.
Well,
the lesser sentience.
And Littleton's a pretty big, sprawling
it's
city.
Huge.
You know, it's not like one little central area.
Mm-mm.
It has fingers that kind of extend all
around.
Over the place.
Yeah. Two different counties.
So, but Ellie Modesset, I've read his books, and I want to say I've read all his books, but I've learned.
Yeah, we don't say that.
This is why you don't know.
Okay, you haven't read everything I've written.
Aw, Nathan.
Nathan Lowell. I've tried to read most of his books. And one of my favorite books of all time is The Forever Hero. And I've made reference to that book because I've reviewed other books in the show that have a very similar theme that seems as if they've been inspired by The Forever Hero.
Hmm.
But Ellie Modesset is right up there with Raymond E. Feist, Magician's Apprentice. I mean, he really has, I would say, is foundational in terms of the fantasy and the books that he writes.
Hmm. Interesting.
Very so it was good to hear from him. So a shout out to our new listener.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Ellie Mardesit.
Yep.
Yeah, hopefully we're saying that correctly. If we're not.
Yeah, did he send the
leave us a voice?
He did. Mod,
yeah, he did.
Mardesit. Mardesit.
So you are not saying it.
No, I'm just saying it faster. Ellie Mardesit.
You're not saying it. Just because you're saying it incorrectly faster, you're still saying it incorrectly. Mardesit.
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 Mob.
Junior. Ellie Mardesit.
Mardesit. Junior. Ma Bell. AT&T. Mardesit. All right. All right, well, welcome to the show.
Hopefully we did not butcher that.
Mardesit.
Yeah.
Ellie Mardesit. And if you'd like to come on, you're welcome anytime. All Absolutely. Right, well, let's get to it. Speaking
and of... And correct us.
Yes, we do have a great guest for you today. His name is Greg Hurwitz. He has a new book out now. It is number 9 in the Orphan X series. And it is titled Lone Wolf. And man, oh man, oh man, let me tell you something. This is quite the thrill ride. You want action? This book delivers it and then some. So in the book, Evan Smoke, a.k.a. Orphan X, former government assassin, starts out by a simple little case. It almost sounds like a Hardy Boys or a Nancy Drew case. He's trying to track down his niece's lost dog. And from there, he stumbles into a case involving human trafficking, murder, and a female assassin who only goes by the moniker The Wolf. I found this book. Listen, this is a very funny book. It is a thrill a minute. It is full of intrigue. It's got surprises. And like I said, plenty of action. And Greg is a great guy to talk to. Laura and I both enjoyed this conversation. So here now, talking about his book, Lone Wolf, this is Greg Hurwitz.
I'm in Los Angeles.
Oh, nice.
How about you?
It's you, Mr. Hollywood. We are in Denver, Colorado.
Nice. All right. Tattered cover zone.
That's
tattered
right.
Cover world. Yeah.
So Michael Bennett zone.
I am.
Yeah. Michael Bennett. Yeah.
I'm directly across the street, where the school I teach at East High School here in Denver. I'm directly across the street from the original tattered cover.
Are you really?
Sure. Yeah.
I've never done an event there in my whole career. 24 books. I got to figure that out someday.
We are ending this conversation right now. It's been great chatting with you.
Because you're going to go over and arrange an event for me. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they're so nice over there. We did an author event with Alma Katsu. I don't know if you know her. She does thrillers at CIA.
Wonderful.
And we met her right before the pandemic, probably the last event she ever did.
Right before it, yeah.
Before the pandemic at the Tattered Cover, yeah. It's a great place.
It is.
It is indeed.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Greg. We'll hook it up for you.
Excellent.
All right. How's it going today? Hanging
great.
In. Oh, you know what I saw? I saw you post an unboxing video online and you were talking about you still now after so many books, you still get excited about it. And I thought that was really cool to see that, you know, you're not afraid to put that out there. That's fun.
It's great, man. I mean, how can you get sick of this?
Right.
If you do, go do another job.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So let's talk about your the latest one in the series, Greg. This is a tale of delivery robots, adversarial pattern shirts, and the dangers of little old ladies. Greg, what was it that inspired you to write this latest in the series, in the Orphan X series?
Well, I make sure with each of the Orphan X books that I'm resetting for new readers, right? But there also is a bigger arc. So anyone can come on board with any of the books. But with Lone Wolf, it opens with an event that's pretty unsettling for Evan. I mean, Evan is not only, he's in the orphan program. It's named because this program that's buried deep in the DOD gets kids out of foster homes who won't ever be missed and trains them to be assassins. So basically, if they're killed or tortured, no one cares. They're full cutout men. There's no one to miss them. And he never met either of his parents. And this book begins with him locating a man who claims that he could be his father, and he goes to see him. We don't know what happens with that right away, but the events of it are profoundly unsettling for him in a way they haven't been. And so Orphan X, who's one of the world's greatest assassins, we find him undone. And he gets a phone call because part of how he operates now, having fled the program, is he has a encrypted phone line, 1-855-2-NOWHERE, which you can call. So give it a go.
Oh, wow.
And see what happens. And the phone rings, and you know, he thinks he's going to start really small and get back on his feet. And it's a phone call from a little girl whose dog has gone missing. Yeah. And so it's the most humiliating, right? It's like an Encyclopedia Brown case, not an Orphan X mission, right?
I was thinking Encyclopedia Brown when he the case of that. Yeah, that's exactly what I thought of when I saw that.
Yeah. Orphan X and the case of the missing dog. And it's a, also it's a hideous little mutt chihuahua mix. And so he goes, look, he scrapes himself up and he goes because you start small. And what happens is that this tiny little mission, this tiny personal little mission, telescopes into something that's enormously vast and threatening. And there's a sequence where I sort of amp the suspense and thriller aspects and action through a whole number of things. And by the time he gets out the other end, you know, he went in thinking it was a one on a scale of 10, one out of 10, and it wound up being like a 13.
Right. That sequence.
Unlucky 13.
It was absolutely amazing. I was starting to read it. I'm like, oh, okay, now this. And it just kept going and going and going. I'm like, my God, is this man never quits? It was absolutely spectacular.
Oh, thank you.
I love that.
Thank sequence. You. I had so much fun writing that, Dave.
You know, you know, one thing that I like that I came across out of this book, it does feel like you're having fun. This is a fun, but you have a chapter that simply, it's just entitled Laughing, and it's one sentence long, and it's like they continue to laugh at it. It was hilarious. No, it's such it was such a fun read and such an
I'm glad to hear it. Look, if I'm not having fun writing it,
yes,
no one's gonna have fun reading it.
Yeah.
Is that I'm curious too, because it's number 9 in the series, I think. And you know, great praise, early praise on Goodreads is fantastic.
Thank you. Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is that how you keep it fresh for you? Because when you were first starting the series, you know, did you envision number 9 at all? Or were you just like, I just got to get through this first book?
You know, what's weird? I wrote it on spec, which means, you know, I got no place in my career where I could do multiple book deals. And I just went off and wrote it. It's really weird in hindsight because it wasn't really conscious, but I wound up with my same editor and I'm with Macmillan. I was with St. Martin's. I switched with Orphan X to go to Minotaur, just a different imprint. I'm with Penguin Random House in the UK, but I went off on my own instead of just saying, let's re-up the deal. Cause I wanted to make sure everybody was in on it. And I kind of thought, look, I'd been thinking about something like this. And then I'd shuffle it to the back burner of my brain. And I wrote another book and another book and another book. And I think, honestly, I was kind of afraid to write it because I wanted to strive to write something that might someday be mentioned in the pantheon with Bond and Bourne and Reacher.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I just kept putting it off and putting it off. And so when I wrote it, I was sort of like, here it is. Like, let's go if everybody's in. And it wound up being this sort of magical ride, you know? So I knew in some ways I had ideas for things. I couldn't imagine that I'm where I am. Well, I shouldn't say I couldn't imagine, but I'm delighted to be as excited for this book to come out as I was for the first one to come out, as I was for my first novel to come out. Yeah. And I can't wait. Like, I'm already working on what's next and I'm just loving it. And, you know, as long as I hope that comes through, in the writing of it. But there's a quotation I often cite from Joan Didion. Oh. And she said, I write so I know what I think.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's a great way to look at it. And there's some sort of symbiotic relationship of me with Evan where I'm thinking about things and then I'm writing a scene and then he figures something out that's useful for me in my life. And then like, there's this really weird confluence. And so I'm as excited as anybody to figure out what's up next for him and how I can capture that in a way that I hope is riveting.
It's therapeutic in a way. Yeah.
My students will tell you that I speak to show what I don't know. So it's kind of, you know, it's along those same lines, but just a little bit twisted.
What is that? That's your Mark Twain, right?
That is, it's more Mark Twain-esque. Yeah. Now, great. This is a great prologue that really grabs the reader's attention. What with the half of a human ear in Evan's pocket and a sweating bald bouncer, which I think I feel like half the bouncers are there out there are sweating and bald. When you start off a novel with a teaser like that in the prologue, are you kind of, do you, and I don't even know if that was your prologue to begin with, or you, you know, you grabbed it from later and popped it in there, but are you thinking of that person in that bookstore holding in their sweaty little hands, their grubby little hands with your book and trying to grab them? Is that part of the conscious decision to do that?
So first of all, I take great offense at the notion that they have grubby hands. I do not view my readers as the unwashed
man. Good for you, Greg.
They're immaculate, Dave. Immaculate.
We take all comers, okay?
Okay.
But what's weird is I don't write predominantly with the reader in mind.
Probably a good thing, though, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not writing to market. I'm writing to think, what's the best structure? I'm writing in a way towards sort of an ideal that I have internally. And if I can get that ideal right, then it'll function. And then a lot of times, like with my editors, they might say, look, no one's met Candy McClure. There's the sort of Orphan V, who's Evan's frenemy, nemesis, love interest, tried to kill him once. Very complicated relationship.
Yeah.
That has been likened to Batman and Catwoman. But you know, we need to reset, right, for readers who are new to this book. So there certainly is time where I'll go, okay, or you know, now and then, let's say I get into, let's say there's a reference that's too precious or fancy pants, right? I like to lace them in a way that's sort of like, oh, if you catch the reference, great. And if you don't, it doesn't matter because it works regardless. Like I don't want to have my hand visible, right? I don't want people to think they're reading. I want them to be lost in it.
Right.
But the initial stages when I'm doing it, I'm really thinking, what's a beautiful form? What would a beautiful thriller be like? How would it be structured? What's the pacing? How can I wrench people open? I'm thinking more in those ways than about, you know, Dave's horde of, you know, orcs who evidently attend bookstores at the tattered cover. I don't know what sort of people you have, but
we are the great unwashed here. This is the Mile High City, Greg. We are the great unwashed. I hate to break it to you, but
the tattered cover is also on a street called Colfax, which is notorious in Denver.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's a spectacular, you know, bookstore. There's a few of them that are like these anchors in the culture. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. The Poison Pen, I think.
And Poison Pen, Murder by the Book in Houston's amazing. Yeah. Curious in New York is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. We can go on and nerd out for our independent bookstore love. Yeah. But
now, Greg, you do something in this book, and I just love this. And I have never seen a dedication quite like this one. This was really an amazing dedication. You went to great lengths to thank all the people. And you never really think about it. You think about, most people think about the creating of a novel as a singular act. It's one person hacking away. Hacking at, I don't know how you use all your fingers when you type. I don't know. But, or maybe you write by hand. I don't know. If only there was a way to find out. But it's not a singular act. And you go to great lengths to point out and just to thank all the people behind the scenes. There really are a lot of people that go into the creating and marketing and everything that there is about this book.
Yeah, I mean, when I was younger and dumber, I used to think that writing novels was a solitary venture.
Right.
And we're constantly in conversation, right? I mean, one of the things that's essential with novels, it's one of the things I love so much about going out on tour and seeing people, is every time a book is read, it's an act of collaboration, right? If I sell a million copies of an Orphan X book, there's a million different movies playing in people's heads. So the audience is engaged in a way. They don't all see the same movie. Like, you know, if I write a screenplay and get a movie made, everyone has a different emotional response, but they all see the same movie. But, you know, another part of that is there's an unbelievable small ecosystem within publishing of just unbelievable and unlikely excellence. You know, I feel like we're at a place right now where we take a lot of things for granted. And I think there's a lot of ways that we feel like the world is atomizing, or we're losing certain structures or communities or institutions, or, you know, a shared fabric that's sort of woven from all sides. And I think it really makes a lot of sense to pause and look at this thing of like what it takes to just to publish a book and get it out in the world. The number of people, it's the printing presses, it's the IP, it's the lawyers, it's the editors, it's the jacket designer, it's the foreign sales, it's the guys who, you know, are running, you know, loading the crates. There's so many things that go into it. It's sort of as a marvel.
We don't have to thank the lawyers. You could have skipped the lawyer.
Now you're quoting Shakespeare. You went from Mark Twain to Shakespeare. That's right. You can't be trusted. No one can trust a drama teacher. No one's safe, man.
That's the truest thing you've said in this interview so far.
But you know, so it really is. I think it's a moment where we shouldn't just be criticizing and concerned with all the things that, you know, we rightly can be concerned with. I think we also have to turn an eye to the things that are structured and holding and the sort of excellence that occurs within an esteemed publishing house. It's amazing. It's amazing how much all these people love books. It's amazing how the sales team and the marketer and the publicist, and we can go down the whole list of it. It's just extraordinary. And so I had this moment when I finished the book of thinking who I wanted to dedicate it to. And I had this sort of swell of a gratefulness for the fact that I send this off and it goes into this bizarre and idiosyncratic sort of singular machine of experts who just love this stuff the way that we do. And they all, you know, grab an oar and row the thing out there into the free marketplace of ideas. Ooh, it's pretty majestic.
I like that.
I like that. I think that's great. I'm a lifelong reader, and it's cool to think about that because, you know, you're right. When you're just reading and you're a teenager, you're like, oh, this Stephen King book is just Stephen King. You know what I mean? It's just the man.
Yeah. But we take for granted, like, well, we can always have books. It's easy to have books. No problem. Right. We'll always have all this stuff. And it's like, you know, to hold something in your hands, to really think about everything that goes through getting it there. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, do you ever get anything delivered by one of these delivery robots? We saw a few on the campus of the University of Arizona when we were down there recently, and they were a lot of fun.
Well, I don't know. They perhaps might feature prominently in an upcoming work. So
maybe.
I shouldn't state this.
Okay.
I've been looking at those. I've been really fascinated. There's a thread through the series dealing with AI and technology, but not from just like a hard grit. I don't really write like Tom Clancy thrillers where the aim is the tech. I'm always interested in pulling apart the sort of ethical implications. A few books ago in Prodigal Son, you know, one of the things that's at the center of that book that Evan's up against is a sort of military industrial private complex. They're trying to figure out how to equip these drones. I mean, one of the things that was of interest to me back then was that these drone operators who are in a literally like a container, like a shipping container in the desert, they could be in, you know, lined up like air conditioned offices, you know, go to work, kill people by video control, pick up Starbucks and milk and go home. Same instances of PTSD as soldiers who were in the field.
Wow.
And I was kind of captivated by that. And so one of the things that people were thinking of developing, and again, this is in an earlier book, is to figure out, well, is there any way we can spare soldiers this entirely by creating a sort of digital conscience? Like what could go wrong there, right? Where somebody can analyze the facial ID of something if they're on a cleared list, can commit the execution, and no human has to bear the cost.
Oh my goodness.
And one of the things that Evan reflects on in that book is the cost that he's willing to carry as an assassin, the human cost, the trauma that we carry, the suffering that we incur by our necessary or unnecessary, right, are either necessary acts of horrific violence or our sins. That's the only break we have on not having more war. Yeah. If it's utterly painless, there's no cost to it. And so those are the sorts of things that interest me. And so I've been thinking a lot about AI in a way that's a bit more philosophical, about what that actually means for us. And again, we kind of come to a head of Evan encountering this thing that blows up and really looking at what we might be facing in the future around this topic.
Yeah, a lot probably. I mean, we're at the very beginning stages. So it's the worst as it will ever be. It's the least usable, the least good. Mm. And it's pretty amazing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Joey, and Joey's back again in this one. And she is so much fun. What a great character you've created. A lot of fun to read. It sounds like you really enjoyed writing for her. She's also good at picking locks. And I'm curious. So as a writer, are you a method writer? Do you have to go out and try out all the different things?
He's looking around.
Oh, he's getting up out of his. This is exciting. Now, Greg has left his seat. He's gotten up and he's, I'm assuming, maybe a lock pick.
Look at these beauties. Look at these beauties.
Oh, awesome.
A nice, lovely leather pouch with a set of tools in it.
And guess what, Dave? It looks like I'm at home in LA, but I'm right outside the door to your classroom right now.
Dear God.
I do. It doesn't mean that I do it well. Like, one of the things I say in interviews is I did a lot of mixed martial arts training and fighting and choke holds to practice for this. It doesn't imply that I'm good at these things.
Right.
You know, my training was largely a process of me having my face introduced consecutively to the training mat over the process of 10 weeks. But I do go after it. And so, yeah, I did do some training with lock picking. I don't hack, and she's a brilliant hacker. I have friends who are hackers who are just incredible, and that's who I rely on.
Wow. So that is, yeah, hacking is something. Like, I feel like anybody out there can pick up a lock set and fiddle around with it.
How hard is it, though? I got to know. Is it that hard, or is it?
It depends on the lock.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We talked to Jeffrey Deaver. He said he struggled with a lock for about 2 hours. He ordered a set off of Amazon, spent about 2 hours fiddling with it, and then just gave up.
He's a wonderful writer, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, and a great guy to chat with, as are you, Greg. So you do enjoy the research. It sounds like to me you like to really get into it, huh?
I don't think we should do anything. Once we can meet our basic needs, I don't think we should do anything that we don't want to do that doesn't seem like fun. That's sort of my operating premise. You know, and then if you hold that as one premise and then just like drive and follow your absolute curiosity as the other, that's a pretty good way to go forward.
We need a quote or a t-shirt.
I would like that t-shirt.
I would buy that.
Let's get them made.
Yeah.
Okay. Greg, we'll put them up in the Orphan X store.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just going to say, Greg, you already sell some merch there. So let's get that one up there. What is the most outrageous or outlandish thing you did in the name of research for one of your books? Besides trying to break into our house, for God's sakes.
I would say physically, probably going up in a stunt airplane.
Oh.
And doing barrel rolls over the Pacific.
Oh my
God. I would say psychologically going undercover in a mind control cult.
Oh, wow.
Whoa, what was that for?
Huh.
That was for a book. It's the one instance where my research, if I had written it as it was, people wouldn't have believed it. The suspension of disbelief would have been too great.
Oh no.
But I was building my own cult. I did all this reading. My wife's a psychologist, you know, a lot of talking with her, a lot of source material, research, scenarios, history. And then I was like, I got to just go see this in action. And people who don't live in Los Angeles say, well, how did you find a cult?
we got them here. We got the mother god here in Colorado. Yeah, there's a Netflix series, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on a female cult leader, which are a little more unusual.
Mm-hmm. How long did you last in that great experiment, Greg?
They do these kind of big lockdown events where everyone's in a big room. It's like a big, you know, hotel ballroom by the airport. And how cults work is they're not trying to. We always think that they're getting people who are like, you know, homeless or estranged or all screwed up in some way. Cults want people who are very basically normal, because we respond predictably to certain situations, but at times of transition. That's why they recruit at airports and college campuses, right? Bus stops, because they want people who can react predictably. And so, you know, so I went to this event. It was like a kind of, you know, no one needs to leave long thing. And, you know, they seat you in a horseshoe so you can see everybody. And then they say, everyone who's ready for change, stand up. And when you're in a room of 200 people and everyone is standing but you, you start to get a sense of the sort of social pressure that's exerted on you.
Wow.
And then you understand why they recruit people who tend to be healthier. Because if I'm a delusional schizophrenic, what do I care? If I'm queuing to different, right? It's why magicians, when they pick a magician's assistant, they pick the most ordinary looking person because they want to take advantage of predictable reactions. So the sort of language and approach of persuasion is always of interest to me. And, you know, and that's one of the things in Lone Wolf, which is spelled out quite significantly about how this is happening algorithmically. you know, one of the other rules of mind control cults is what's called privacy deprivation, which means you don't go anywhere that you can reflect. First, they limit your access to outside information, right? You don't call, you're up in some, you know, cabin out of, that happens to be out of cell phone reach. And then you're surrounded with people 24/7.
Right.
And so you have privacy deprivation. There's not time for personal reflection. Well, we have a device that can limit us to outside information. We can unfriend people as we wish. We can choose certain news sources and filter out others. And we have full privacy deprivation for ourselves. We take it in. I see people at the urinal that are still texting, right? We see people tripping as they're over their luggage as they board an airplane. It's with us everywhere. And so a big part of Lone Wolf is saying, well, what happens if we let that, you know, so now what do we have? We have deep machine algorithmic learning as overseen by teams of addiction specialists whose only job is to turn you into a profit center. So what's that going to look like for our kids, for anxiety, for news, for polarization? And so that's something that's of a lot of interest to me, is watching the ways that that mentality has seeped into a new version of the universe.
Yeah. And I love what you do in the book. It's not just a fun thriller. It is fun to read and it is exciting and it is entertaining, but you are also asking these, you're a deep guy, Greg, you're getting, you know, we're scratching below the surface here. We're getting the deep philosophical questions of our time. And speaking of, it is now time for our deep philosophical segment. These are called Quick Six. Now, these are six quick questions, Greg, in which we find out just a little bit more about you. But you can take your time with the answers. We really should change the title of that. Here we go. Greg, what is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
True Detective.
That's good.
The new one?
Oh, it's phenomenal. If it's truly binged, as in all the way through, because they're all available, it would be Fargo. The new season of Fargo is superb.
We just started watching the new season.
I love The Crown. I mean, like, always The Crown. I always think what an easy job he has, right? All he has to do is write 10 Oscar-winning scripts every year, and you have a season of The Crown. Like, what a breeze.
What a breeze. Life is fun. What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Faulkner's Yaknapatawpha County.
Oh, that's a great one.
Wow. We're quick with that one. Okay.
Thought about it a few times or two.
It sounds like it. Greg, how about this? Give us one of your favorite movies of all time.
Tony Scott and Denzel Washington's Man on Fire, meaning the newer iteration of that. Is that Helgeland? Hang on.
When you said Tony Scott and Denzel, my first thought was The Train, Unstoppable.
Which is great. It is Helgeland, of course it is. Yeah, I have to name the screenwriter. I just had a moment.
Oh.
That movie wrecks me. Mm. And part of it is in a movie, usually the first act line is it about the 30 page mark in a script or the half hour mark in a movie. I mean, you're a drama teacher, Dave, so you know absolutely. This already.
Yep.
You know, we have tend to have a three act instead of a five act structure as with like Shakespearean theater. But what's amazing with Man on Fire is the first act is an hour. The first act is all about his relationship with the girl. And so it's really interesting. And only Tony Scott could get that done and through, right? Because anyone else, the studio would be like, dude, right? Turn the corner. And so you're so invested in their relationship that when the coil goes into the action, it's just so like, it's so gut-wrenchingly personal.
That's interesting. I haven't seen that one.
What is wrong with you people?
I know.
There's a lot wrong.
I thought you were serious interlocutors.
Clearly, you've been deluded on that thinking. How about that?
It's my turn, I guess.
I apologize.
How about one of your favorite books?
Oh, gosh. Sound and the Fury. The Things They Carried, Tim O'Brien. Great Gatsby.
Yeah, those are beautiful books.
Crime and Punishment. The perfect thriller for me is Thomas Harris's Red Dragon, the one that preceded Silence of the Lambs. It's a perfect thriller.
Yeah.
I mentioned Faulkner. You talked about Faulknerian character depth. My God. I mean, the way he writes Doll Your Ride, and there's all the William Blake imagery.
Yes.
And it's chilling. I mean, I still remember the first time I read that, I must have been 22, 23, and I was in an apartment and I was alone, and I got up and checked in every closet, beneath every bed, in all the it was like I was 7 years old and refused to go to bed.
I was a teenager and sweated through it, just sweated out of fear, just fear.
It goes down into your bone marrow.
Yeah. I reread it recently and it's still amazing. Yeah.
He's a marvel. I mean, he's just amazing.
Greg, how about this? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Oh, gosh. Okay. There's certain things that I claim I'm not good at, and people go, you can't be that bad at it, really, right? Like, are you fishing for a compliment? It can't be as bad as you claim.
Yeah.
My singing is so extraordinarily reprehensible. Like, I can't hum. I can't make if I'm so. And by the way, I have one of my daughters is a very gifted singer, but I'll say, oh, you know, this, even if it's like a top 40 song that I'm referencing, I can't make the noises that come out of my mouth resemble the song closely enough that people can identify what the song is.
We're going to take that as a no.
That would be a no, Dave. That would be a no.
That's a gotcha question is what that is, Dave.
It is.
No, we get half and half.
It's about 50%, yeah. It's amusing enough to keep it in, though.
Absolutely.
Last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
Ah.
Oh, he's got it right nearby, right next to the lockpick set.
West Heart Kill.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Dan McDorman. As lovers of mysteries, you will love this. It is a book that is, it's very meta. He tells the story as if, like, parts of it are in second person, right? You'll understand that as the sleuth, you know, arrives at the deserted cabin, that this is a common trope. Your eye's going to be out for certain clues. Is it the heiress who...
Oh, that sounds...
And he pauses at intervals to have nonfiction pieces that are shaped throughout to, like, there'll be an essay on the locked room mystery where he'll just describe the history of it. And then he goes back. And so it's very witty. It's very clever. He's got an encyclopedic knowledge of the form. Also philosophical, historical, political. He's amazing. He tells the story about when Agatha Christie decamped and went missing. I don't know if you know these stories. He keeps putting us on hold, and then he'll take a little detour of our memory of favorite tropes and dynamics and historical touchstones, and then he'll return to the plot but keep talking to us as we all understand this. We're all in a community of mystery readers. So it's pretty wonderful. It's quite cerebral. And you know, he's clearly just whip smart.
Nice. Awesome. Greg, as are you, and it was a delight chatting with you. Really enjoyed the new book, Lone Wolf. So much fun. Really, had a great time talking to you. And please make sure if you're in the neighborhood, we'll take you over the Tattered Cover. We won't have to break in. You won't need your lockpick set, and we'll introduce you around.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
You got it, Greg. Take care.
Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you both.
Bye.
Okay.
Yep. Bye-bye. The Inside Flap. All right. Thank you so much to Greg for hopping on. Check out his book, check out his book, Lone Wolf. So let's go ahead and open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Laura Medicus.
She comes from Silver Spoon Gold.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called The Art of Happiness by the Dalai Lama.
Whoa! I do believe this is the first time we've
Here's the thing, though.
The Dalai Lama?
Yeah. So when you look at this book, I got it from the library. Uh-huh. It says by the Dalai Lama. It's not by the Dalai Lama. This book is written by a Western psychiatrist named... He's got a really boring name. Sorry. Yes, Andrew?
Well, or could it be that it's a reincarnated Dalai Lama?
Definitely is not. Because he's still alive. Dalai Lama is still alive.
Now, could the Dalai Lama be reincarnated multiple times? I mean... Uh-huh.
While he's still alive?
Yeah. No, he's still alive.
Okay. He could shed some DNA?
Yeah.
And is there some kind of way to...
No. So his name is Dr. Howard Cutler, and he spent a week, just 1 week. I hope this guy doesn't listen to this.
Who wrote this?
Dr. Howard Cutler, a Western psychiatrist, wrote this. And I say Western because the Dalai Lama's Eastern religion.
Oh, I thought you meant because he wore cowboy hats.
Yeah. So he spent a week with the Dalai Lama, and he wrote a book about his experience. So the things in this book that I found incredibly meaningful and that actually did impact my outlook on life were words and thoughts from the Dalai Lama. Not from Dr. Cutler, who
let's hope he's not listening.
He comes off as a little annoying.
Oh, man.
I think he might be
this
okay
might
with
be
that.
This might be our first for the Inside Flap.
There's no way this guy's going to listen.
Okay.
There's no way. And
we
if
didn't
he
think
does,
it was any way Ellie Modest was going to listen.
Let's talk about it.
Now, is annoying the right adjective, or is it more opinionated?
He's not opinionated. He has a lot of, he has opinion, but he has a lot of questions for the Dalai Lama. A lot of overthinking things, a lot of scientific studies that he is interested in.
And we really should get the Dalai Lama on the show.
Yeah, that's
what we did. Andrew, that's who we should get.
And we should get his opinion.
There we go.
Of the guy who wrote the book.
Let's do that. Let's do that.
Howard Kessler fellow.
I'll get right on that one. Yeah. But, okay, all of those things that I just said aside, this is still a worthwhile book for you.
Okay.
Right. If you're interested in getting into Buddhist philosophy, and or you find yourself thinking about happiness and life a lot, which is more my case as I'm approaching my 50th birthday.
Coming up. No matter of days now. Yeah. Matter of days.
Yeah. Wow. So.
5 days.
Half a century.
I have a job.
Andrew and I are already in the club.
I know you guys are. So. I take comfort in that. Yeah. So I have a job where I work for wealthier people, right? I'm an interior designer. They're people who are financially very comfortable compared to most people on Earth. I think that we would say that on the planet. And what I have noticed from working with them is that money, after your basic needs are met, right? And then a little sum, in my opinion, money doesn't buy you happiness. Like you are a happy person or you're not in general. So this book goes over this quite a bit. And I found it very interesting. So a person has a level of happiness as a human being. And it will spike sometimes, right? You'll feel happier than others or joyful even. And then it's going to dip at other times in your life and through times of trouble. But it always goes back to that same level of general happiness. And you can kind of raise your level depending. The Dalai Lama believes that you can. But it's pretty steady. It's a steady level.
Okay.
So what I find interesting is the Dalai Lama differentiates between pleasure and happiness. So a summer vacation is going to give me pleasure. It won't bring me happiness. A nicer home will bring me some pleasure. But if I'm unhappy, I'm still going to be unhappy. So I've seen this over and over again. Most of my clients, thank goodness, are happy people in general. So I know, like, me helping them with their home, this isn't going to necessarily bring them happiness, but it will bring them pleasure.
Okay.
But I know that at the core level, there'll always be a certain level of happiness for them. So I find that really interesting. So my other big takeaway from this is the Dalai Lama's belief that all human beings want two things. And the two things that he thinks that you want are happiness and to not suffer. And he says that if you can think of your fellow human beings in very basic terms like this, that you'll find you have more compassion for other people. So a neighbor who's getting on your nerves, we have a crazy neighbor behind us. Basic level, this guy, he wants to be happy and he doesn't want to suffer. And if you can just look at people in a very more basic way, you will find a little more like,
well, what
if
that guy's happiness is making me suffer? By having to listen to
that's
his
pleasure.
Music.
That's pleasure, though. He also might have some mental illness and drug use going on, but we don't know.
You
that.
Can scratch the word "might" from that sentence.
Yes. So I recommend this book. I got a lot out of it. There are some chapters that weren't as meaningful for me as others, but the chapters that were meaningful were very meaningful. Mm-hmm. It's a 4.17 on Goodreads.
And what about all the questions? All this Howard fellow with his questions.
You know, he's fine. He structures it well. And I think if you are coming from someone who maybe doesn't know a whole lot about Buddhism, like me, you would probably enjoy it because it's framed in a more scientific, Western kind of way.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, I got to wonder, the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there has to be like all kinds of books written.
Oh, yeah. By, there's so many.
Like by him or about him.
Yeah, and, quotes and stuff
like that. So yeah. I just wonder, like, why this book?
This book, The Art of Happiness, does have his picture on the cover as well. And I have to assume if it's going to say by the Dalai Lama, then it was meant to be an in-depth kind of conversation. It should really be in conversation with the Dalai Lama, perhaps.
Yeah. Is it written like a in conversation form?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of written like that with him talking and teaching over the course of, you
like,
know, a week.
So it's like Interview with the Vampire.
Exactly. Basically. Like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, I really love the book. I took a lot from it. And don't you worry, if you're a Christian, it's not going to convert you to Buddhism. It's just the philosophy. So.
Hey, you've been doing an awful lot of yoga recently.
I have been doing a lot of yoga. not related at all.
Sure. Not related at all.
What, yeah.
Now, to be honest, I mean, what the hell does yoga have to do with Buddhism?
They believe that it was developed.
It's, what do you mean?
It came from there. It came from there.
It's meditation.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, in any case, let's check that book out. And that is recommended by...
You know...
She comes from...
thank you. I like that song.
Button. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, it's weird that I have started yoga.
You literally just said, this will not convert you to Buddhism.
But I've been doing yoga.
You started doing yoga.
I have. At the same time that I've been reading this book. Dalai Lama stuff.
Right, listeners, be careful.
So here's a local reference.
Be careful.
The next thing you know, she's going to be enrolling in classes at Naropa University.
There we go.
Well, yeah, and if she starts walking around in a robe, I'm really going to be...
Every night, baby. Every night.
Watching out. Yeah. All right, and that's recommended by...
Laura Medicus.
My book this week.
Dave Medicus.
It's a bonfire. Turn the lights out.
Oh, man, do I have a good book for you guys this week. It is called Fever House. It is written by Keith Rossin, a friend of the show, former guest of the show, Keith Rossin. And this book is such a trip. It is absolutely nuts in a good way. So the book, Fever House, starts out with two guys. And these guys are kind of like low-rent enforcers for a mafia boss. They're going around trying to be tough guys and collect on some debts from some people who owe the boss. When they happen to stumble across this guy, and this guy owes the boss money, but the more they interrogate him, the more weird he seems. He's got a woman there. They find out he is hiding a severed hand. And it turns out, now stay with me.
I'm with you.
I see your face. When you are in the presence of this severed hand, when it's nearby.
I have no idea where you're going to go with this.
Tell me about it. I didn't know where Keith Rossin was going to go with
this. Is this a Monkey's Paw reference?
I don't know. Maybe that's a great point.
That's
maybe
good,
it originally came from that. When you're in the presence of this severed hand,
you feel
like you really want to hurt somebody. But it also kind of it makes you feel good, and it incites violence, but it instills good feelings in you as you're inciting this violence. So the severed hand is popular too. There is a shadowy government agency trying to track down this hand, and this agency, they're helped out by a mysterious being named Michael. Now, Michael is a guy... And you get to hear from Michael's, yes?
Hang on a second here. We got to back it up here.
Okay.
So if you're in the presence of the hand,
yes,
then you want to hurt people.
You want to hurt people, yes.
How do they...
And here's the thing is...
You feel its aura.
But you feel good. But you feel good. But how can
it,
you consider, like, wanting to hurt somebody isn't by nature good?
Yeah. You don't think Mike Tyson, when he was punching somebody out, you don't think he felt good?
I don't think I would describe that as good. He might feel...
Pleasure.
You're taking pleasure out of it.
Not happiness. Hey.
Yeah. You're taking pleasure.
How are they storing the severed hand? Is it gross?
Well,
is it in ice?
It's traveling all around because when you see it, you want it. It's not in ice. No. In the beginning, I think it's in a bag. I forget. It's like a plastic pizza bag or something like that.
Is it decaying?
Remember. Maybe it's in a pizza box. They don't, it's in all kinds of states. In fact, one guy actually, when he lost a hand, he tried to cut off his own hand.
Oh, to replace
some kind
it?
Of fevered brain of his. He was thinking maybe he could replace the hand. So this guy tried to cut off his own hand to try to replicate the hand. But anyway, so let's go back to this government agency who's trying to find the hand. They are being helped by this being named Michael. Now, Michael is a guy, and like I said, you get to hear a lot of points of view in this book. Points of view. And Michael is a guy who had wings, but they keep him clipped at all times. And so he can't escape. He bleeds black fluid, but he is getting these messages about this telepathic messages about where this hand is. So he keeps telling the government agency where the hand is, but it's always like the agency is always like one step behind. Like this hand is jumping around from owner to owner to owner. And that, now all that, that is just the start of this book. There's also a female punk rock musician who had a hit single with a song that was layered with a subliminal message in it. There's a detached eyeball that might have magical powers. There's just a lot going on.
Huh.
And like I said, it switches POVs all over the place in a very rapid pace. So you get to hear from everyone, which was fantastic for me. Yes, Andrew.
Are these relics, Dave?
They might be. Now, also, what I did enjoy is the dialogue. The dialogue just snaps, crackles, and pops in this book. The violence and gore are dialed up to an 11. It's peppered with black humor all throughout. It's really the kind of book, to me, would make a good Quentin Tarantino movie. This is a wild ride. It's very well written. It's fast-paced. It's wacky. It's weird. It's delightful. Part thriller, part horror, part crime caper, part black comedy. It is written in so many different genres. I don't know what to call it. I just know that it worked. This is a true original. And good news for me, it's the first in a series. So I'm very excited about that. It's a new book. It's out now. It is called Fever House. Fever House number one in the Fever House series, written by Keith Rawson. And if you go back, I think it's in 2000. We talked to him a long time ago, but I really loved his book of short stories too that we talked to him about. So check this one. Yes, Andrew.
Sounds like you really got to hand it to him.
Okay. Yes, indeed.
I might have been reaching with that one.
No, you want to also keep an eye on this one because it's a good one. All right, Andrew.
Andrew Dowd.
What do you got for us this week?
Hopefully no one really listens to the words in the song.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, but everybody's heard this song, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, everybody...
We just lost our PG-13 rating. Yep.
Our age, yeah.
And so, I'm basically reviewing a second book in a series. It's a book I've waited for, but I reviewed the first book on the show maybe 3 years ago.
Oh.
Mm. 2 years ago, Jake's Magical Market.
By
J.R. Matthews. Mm. And the premise of the first book was Jake is a young man. He's in Earth. He's working in a produce market, and he's back in the walk-in.
Oh, I remember this.
And
this one sounded really good.
Yeah. And, I love the first book.
Yeah.
And if you looked this up on Goodreads, it's got, like, astronomical reviews, right? So the first book...
You know, I really like those, and fantasy does it really well, where a normal person and then something crazy, it like transports you to another world or whatever.
And Jake is a college graduate. He's kind of stuck in time. Mm-hmm. He's in the walk-in, and then basically he comes out of the walk-in, and everybody's dead in the store. The world as he know it is changed.
Oh, I love stuff like that.
And he's just trying to survive.
That's
and
the thing the is, best.
You know, I think it's classified as lit RPG. However, I kind of take a defense that this is considered lit RPG because it doesn't have like the statistics and this and that.
Thank goodness.
Like, I think it's like, well, borderline. Well, the thing is, some of the lit RPGs are so like, okay, this happens. All right. Now the person's stats have changed.
Oh, we should also say literary role-playing game.
Correct. Yeah. And this book doesn't have that at all.
Okay.
So I almost take offense that this book is called
lit RPG. Offense.
And so that's the first book. And Jake survives. He meets all kinds of people. He gets into all kinds of shenanigans.
Spoiler.
But what's great is the way the book is written.
Is the name? Have you mentioned the name of this
he
book?
He has not.
The new book, I have not.
No.
Oh, holding on to it. Mm-mm.
So book two is called book is it's called book two.
Oh.
It's called book two, everybody. Yeah. Yep, great title.
A Trek Through Time, and the author is J.R. Matthews.
Okay.
And so this book obviously takes up where the first book you know, leaves off. And so what happens is Jake basically, like, everything just keeps escalating and escalating. And again, he's doing his best to survive. And it goes from Jake's doing his best to for him to survive to now Jake is trying to save Earth. Because what happens is Jake basically gets sent, he gets sent back to Earth, but Earth is now destroyed, completely destroyed. It is a dry husk. There is no life anywhere. It is so desiccated that there's not even anything to eat on there. And so then Jake finds a way to get off of, like, this old Earth, and he basically gets sent back in time onto possibly a different planet. Somehow or another, he kills a god and he assumes the god's power.
This would make a great movie.
Yeah, it would. It would, especially. And there's humor in the yeah. book. Like, Jake doesn't take himself too seriously. And
that's just kind of funny.
If they converted it correctly, there it would be, as the people from St. Louis say, it would be hilarious.
Is that a St. Louis thing?
Well, I make fun of my wife and my mother-in-law.
Do they say hilarious?
They say hilarious.
That's funny.
Yep. So in any case. But so he ends up in this, like, in this new book, and he ends up at a monastery, but he's been sent back in time, like way back in time. And Jake realizes, you know, I have an opportunity to basically save Earth. And so he basically makes it his mission that I basically want to do anything I can to save my planet. So the first book, he's just trying to save himself. This book ups the notch a little bit to saving the entire planet. He ends up at a monastery in the distant past. He's, like, now a god. Not like, and there's all kinds of gods, but he's just like a minor god, right? And he doesn't even know how his powers work. So some of his powers are, he has the ability to kind of like modify time. There are three gods that approach this monastery, three angry gods, and they have it out for him, and they basically want to destroy him. And so the second book basically starts out with him waking up in this monastery, trying to figure out what's going on. And then, you know, one of the gods basically creates a, like, mountain-sized hammer and literally smites Jake. You know? And so then Jake wakes up, and it is kind of like Groundhog Day, and he gets a chance to basically correct. To basically correct what happened. Yeah. But his ability to, like, go back in time and fix things is finite. So, and I know there's, like, time and finite. I know there's a deeper meaning there somewhere, but it eludes me. It eludes me at this moment. But it is a great book. It is a great story. You'll like Jake.
Sounds good.
You'll like the characters in the book that he meets. There is humor in the book. Like, you know, there's one scene where there's some people being real jerks in the book. And so Jake basically creates these rats. And the rats basically, like, crawl into the people's robes and start, like, biting biting all kinds of stuff. You know? So there's
hilarious.
Hilarious. But there's a healthy dose of you know, I would say of comic relief. And also, you know, what you always want is retribution.
I like that.
Yeah. So the book is book two of Jake's Magical Market, called A Trek Through Time.
All right, and that is recommended by
Down.
Which brings us to
audiobook of the week.
Do you guys think the audiobook of the week needs a walk-up jingle? There's no walk-up jingle for the. Okay.
No. All we're right. Fine.
Okay. So my pick this week is is called "You" by Carolyn Kepnes, read by Santino Fontana. Mm-hmm. Now, last week I was telling you about The Institute. That was my pick, and I told you how much I loved the reader, this guy Santino Fontana. So much so that I just simply looked up other books that this guy read, and I found this little gem, which has also been turned into a series on Netflix. You is the ultimate stalker book, told entirely from the point of view of bookshop clerk Joe Goldberg, this snarky, creepy, sadistic, sarcastic, and salacious main character who is obsessed with a woman named Guinevere Beck, a young, pretty woman who comes into the bookstore one day. Of course, he does what any creepy stalker would do. He Googles her and hatches a plan to weave his way into her life. Now, this book is not for the faint of heart. It is vicious. And obviously, the main character is a psychopath. But he is, however, at times a very funny psychopath. And there are so many references to books and authors in here that I really enjoyed. So if you're into books about stalkers,
our daughter is reading it, 17-year-old, and she's loving it.
She is absolutely loving
it. She's listening to it.
The guy's got a very snarky tone to him.
Just kidding.
He is funny. The main character is funny. And it's great to get a lot of Stephen King references, all kinds of stuff in here because he works in a bookstore.
Sounds great.
But yes, it's very graphic. It's gruesome. And
perfect for our 17-year-old. Exactly. Just I'm right reading the Dalai Lama's Art of Happiness, and you two are, I don't
reading
know.
You, Carly Kepnes. Let's take a listen to a clip read by the wonderful Santino Fontana.
Audiobook of the week.
All right, there you go. That's our show for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Episode 243 in the books, and we thank Greg Hurwitz for hopping on board. Check out his new book, Lone Wolf, number 9 in the Orphan X series. Book series. Until next time, my name is Dan Medicus, and we'll see you.
Adios.
Excelsior.
No one can trust a drama teacher.